Hello, it's John Dennis here on Tuesday, the 16th of December. Today, more than a million children living below the poverty line don't receive a free school dinner because of flaws in the funding system, according to figures released in Parliament.
We need to make sure that education funding is targeted much more on a wider definition of deprivation.
Also today, the Palestinian Prime Minister says ending Israeli settlements in the West Bank is key to a two-state peace agreement. So why aren't Israeli politicians discussing it during their election campaign?
Here we are, you know, on the eve of elections. You know, that issue is something that none of the major party candidates finds himself or herself having to address.
And there's a new prime minister in Thailand, a country rocked by political instability. He'll be needing a stiff upper lip.
While he was at Eden, he was a contemporary of Boris Johnson, and David Cameron, the Conservative leader, was a year below him.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, Sandy Waugh's got the news headlines and the papers.
Tens of thousands of retired public sector staff have learnt that their pensions have been overpaid for decades. The Chancellor, Alistair Darling, has said the money need not be repaid, but thousands still face having their pensions cut from April next year. About 5% of retired public sector workers are involved, estimated at tens of thousands of people. The list of investors and banks hit by the alleged $50 billion fraud by US trader Bernard Madoff is growing. Among the banks that have been hit are Britain's HSBC and RBC, Spain's Santander and France's BNP Paribas. Other victims include film director Steven Spielberg's Wunderkinder Foundation charity. US authorities have ordered the liquidation of the trader's brokerage firm Bernard L. Madoff Investment Securities of New York. The death toll from a cholera outbreak in Zimbabwe has risen to 978, according to the United Nations. It represents an increase of nearly 25% in 3 days. The country's president, Robert Mugabe, has claimed the disease no longer exists in the country. UN Chief Ban Ki-moon has said his organization can do little to help Zimbabwe because of its leaders' refusal to allow it to mediate. A Tokyo businessman has been convicted in Japan of abducting but not killing British bar hostess Lucy Blackman. Last year, Joji Obara was acquitted of killing the 21-year-old from Sevenoaks in Kent, but the Tokyo High Court now says he did kidnap her in Tokyo in 2000. A judge said there was no proof Obama alone was responsible for her death. Madonna's paid her former husband Guy Ritchie around £50 million as part of their divorce settlement. The pop queen and the film director were granted a divorce last month. The multi-million pound settlement is about twice the amount Sir Paul McCartney paid to Heather Mills. The financial part of the settlement has been worked out, but custody of the couple's children has yet to be finalised. Look at this morning's papers now. The Times and Daily Telegraph says that a large stake in Royal Mail is to be sold to a foreign company under plans drawn up by ministers. This part private. The Times says, could mean up to 50,000 jobs could be lost. The Guardian reports millions of poor pupils don't receive free school meals as a result of flaws in the funding system. Half of pupils from families in poverty are not getting a free lunch because the income threshold is set lower than the current level used to define poverty. More of this later in Guardian Daily. The Independent leads with the man who conned the world. They describe tentacles of Bernard Madoff stretching further and deeper than anyone imagined. The Financial Times looks at the UK-listed online poker site Party Gaming. It's agreed to pay the US authorities $300 million and plead guilty to a charge related to illegal betting. More on today's stories and breaking news at guardian.co.uk.
More than a million children living in poverty aren't getting free school meals. That's because the income threshold that allows pupils to qualify for free school dinners is set lower than the government's definition of poverty. The Children's Minister, Beverly Hughes, confirmed the figure in an answer to a question from the Liberal Democrats. David Laws is the Lib Dems' education spokesman.
Well, these figures show that half of the poorest children in England are actually missing out on free school meals, which is pretty shocking when most people imagine that the purpose of the exemptions that there are for free school meals is to allow a lot of youngsters from low-income households to get those meals for free. And I think that this helps to explain why so many children who ought to be receiving school meals don't actually get them.
Because of that, schools are actually being underfunded, aren't they? Because a lot of their funding does depend on the number of children getting free school lunches.
Yes, one of the other problems with this data is that because the free school meals statistics are only capturing a very small proportion of those youngsters who are growing up in poverty, a lot of the allocation of cash throughout the education system has tended in the past to follow the free school meals indicator. And many head teachers and others have felt that the free school meals indicator was only a very partial measure of the extent of poverty and educational disadvantage. Now we know that that's true, because we know that roughly half of the children in poverty are not registered for free school meals, and therefore that this indicator is very unsatisfactory, both for delivering free school meals themselves, but also for targeting deprivation in an effective way.
And it also affects performance indicators, because things like school league tables are weighted by how deprived schools are, and that's measured by the number of free school lunches.
Yes, I think this shows that we need a wider measure of educational disadvantage, and that free school meals is far too narrow. And in some parts of the country, we might appear to have a very low number of children on free school meals in a particular school, but it may well be that there's still a large number of children living in poverty in those particular households, and that what you've got is parents who may not be entitled to the benefits, which are a passport to free school meals, but they nevertheless may be on very, very low incomes and be experiencing, in the case of the children, a very similar level of educational disadvantage to children who are growing up in households where the parents are on benefits. So I think that this information raises major policy challenges for the government, not only in delivering free school meals to those youngsters in real need, but also in the way that we target deprivation funding and in the way in which we assess the performance of individual schools.
And how would you like to see the government respond to this?
I'd like to see the government respond in two ways. Firstly, I think that there is a challenge in widening access to free school meals, and in going back to the situation that we had at one stage where more of the households on low incomes could get access to free school meals. We know that in the 1980s, the Tories abolished some of the earlier rules which allowed free school meals to be available to a wider category of youngsters. But secondly, we've got to look again at the way in which we target deprivation funding. And we need to make sure that education funding is targeted much more on a wider definition of deprivation, and that in the allowance that we make for deprivation in measuring school performance, that we have a much more realistic proxy of the schools which are in deprived circumstances.
David Laws. And there's full coverage of that story today at educationguardian.co.uk. Also on The Guardian's website today, Steven Soderbergh talks to Stuart Jeffries about his forthcoming film, Shay, at guardian.co.uk/film. Khaled Diab on the special power of insult expressed in an Arab Muslim throwing his shoe. Have your say about that at guardian.co.uk/comment is free. And introducing the word of mouth Christmas multi-bird roast. We've pulled together a recipe with your tips and filmed the results. See how it's done from beginning to end, and look out for videos from Allegra McEvedy and Matthew Fort on a vegetarian Christmas and alternative puddings later this week. All that, guardian.co.uk/lifeandstyle/word of mouth. After meeting the Palestinian Prime Minister Salam Fayyad, Gordon Brown spoke on the phone with Barack Obama yesterday. They agreed that progress towards peace in the Middle East would be a key international goal next year. Mr. Brown said that one of the largest obstacles to peace was Israeli settlements in Palestinian territories. But Mr. Fayyad told The Guardian's Middle East editor Ian Black the issue wasn't even being discussed during the Israelis' current election campaign.
You know, I tell you what really disturbs me more than anything else in terms of what's going on in Israel right now. I mean, here we are on the eve of important elections in Israel. Everybody would agree. And yet, what I find most remarkable is the one issue that really has greater bearing on the prospects of continued viability of a solution concept which became a matter of international consensus in 2002, namely the two-state solution. Mm. An issue that bears so importantly on the continued viability of the solution concept, namely, you know, continued settlement activity, mm. and settlement activity and settlement in general, settler violence, is not a matter of, you know, public debate in Israel. I find this most remarkable, to tell you the truth. I mean, there seems to me to be a rather worrying disconnect here, you know, between, you know, what's going on in the course, in the run-up to this important election in Israel, and what it is that the government that's likely to emerge, or the government that will emerge, you know, after this election, will have to contend with. I mean, here we are, there's going to be, you know, a Security Council meeting on the issue on Tuesday, and there's no question that, you know, the day after the elections, you know, this government is going to really have to deal with, you know, peace talks, peace process, requirements, roadmap, obligations, all of this. And one of those obligations, you know, pertains to settlement activity, as is well known and documented. We know that. But here we are, you know, on the eve of elections. You know, that issue is something that none of the major party candidates finds himself or herself having to address. That worries me. All I'm really saying, I'm not really terribly reassured by the fact that, you know, this is something that's not being discussed. It's hugely important. It's of great significance. It is definitely to us Palestinians. You know, after all, what is it that is considered to be a key deliverable of this peace process? Ending the occupation began 67. An establishment, independent, viable Palestinian state next to Israel. Isn't it? Mm. I mean, words of George Bush,
sure.
Living in peace and security.
And what is your assessment of the prospects of finding a political resolution to the conflict in the year to come? Obama's going to be president.
Yeah.
It's a big moment, in theory,
yeah.
for the world. What's your feeling? What needs to happen?
I think when I begin to see, you know, greater focus on what is required to preserve the possibility of a solution than we have seen so far, I'll begin to be encouraged. I do not know when this conflict is going to be resolved. What I care more about, you know, in the immediate future, is whether or not sufficient effort is being made to ensure that the requirements of success, the requirements of getting what we really need to do in order to get there, are being taken care of. That's really the litmus test for me, quite frankly. We are able to reach a solution next year, you know, well and good. If we're not, we reach it the year after. The bigger question for me is, when we get to that station, will there still be a train to take? And that is why, you know, I keep going back, you know, in my own thinking, to what it is that has to be done to ensure continued viability of the solution. And therefore, in terms of what is on the table, without really having to, you know, come up with new concepts or new models to resolve this conflict, I draw again attention of the world community to a document that has been agreed by us and Israelis going back to spring of 2003, and that is the Roadmap to Peace. Therein, you have obligations on our side, on the Israeli side, that have been accepted. Commitment to the immediate implementation, quote-unquote, of those obligations was reaffirmed at the Annapolis conference that was held in November of last year. I think this is really a matter that should be accorded highest priority, in my view.
Salam Fayyad, talking to Ian Black. My name's John Dennis, still to come on Guardian Daily. Fans of Nora Batty are mourning the death of the actor Kathy Staff. But the last of the summer wine tourist industry is in rude health.
I think we've got over 800 photographs on the walls, which are going back over the last 25 years, you know, showing all the scenes and cast and crew and so on. So it's a complete, you know, Nora Batty experience.
Thailand's opposition leader, Abhisit Wejjachiva, has become prime minister. the country's third in as many months. His elevation by a vote of MPs follows 6 months of turbulence in Thailand, as Ian McKinnon, The Guardian's correspondent in Bangkok, explains.
Well, he has persuaded enough MPs from the party loyal to Thaksin Shinawatra to cross the floor in support of him. Those were people who used to belong to the People Power Party, which was disbanded a couple of weeks ago when a court decided that they had been guilty of vote buying at the last election last December. So the party was banned, and so was the Prime Minister. So that meant that other parties could then try to form a coalition government, which is what he has done.
And what's been the reaction to his elevation to Prime Minister?
Well, on the streets outside Parliament, there were some protests. A couple of hundred people loyal to the Thaksin Shinawatra and his allies were outside Parliament. But and they did create some trouble. They were very angry. They threw rocks and hurled police barricades and laid siege to the place for a while. But we've seen nothing like the protests of their rivals, the People's Alliance for Democracy, who had they led siege to the airport last week and a couple of weeks ago. And there have been protests, but nothing like on the scale that we've seen before.
Abhisit is an economist. You mentioned the economic crisis facing Thailand, as elsewhere, of course. What are his plans for the Thai economy?
Well, he has said his key priorities are reviving the economy. In Thailand, exports and tourism are absolutely key to the economy. And these have been damaged by the political turmoil of months of the last months, partly image, partly the closure of the airport, which was extremely damaging to the tourism just at the start of the height of the tourist season. Now, unclear what he actually will do for the economy. In fact, it's quite unclear beyond that what his policies are. They're very vague.
And what can you tell us about Abhisit the man? He was educated in Britain.
Indeed, he was born in Newcastle to both his parents are medical professors. He's from a wealthy Thai Chinese family. So after he was schooled in Eton, and then he went to Oxford where he studied politics, philosophy, and economics. Actually, while he was at Eton, he was a contemporary of Boris Johnson, and David Cameron, the Conservative leader, was a year below him.
Ian McKinnon in Bangkok. The actor Kathy Staff, who played Nora Batty in the long-running BBC sitcom The Last of the Summer Wine, has died, aged 80. But in Home Firth, West Yorkshire, where the series was filmed, the memory of Kathy Staff's creation is very much alive. Nora Batty's fictional cottage is let out to holidaymakers at very reasonable rates, as The Guardian's Martin Wainwright reports.
I'm beside the river which goes right through the middle of Home Firth in West Yorkshire, the former textile town where Nora Batty reigned supreme. I'm just making my way up to her cottage, where you can stay. You can make your way up a flight of steep stone steps, which Nora used to advantage when she was using her broom to fend off compo. And inside, I'm about to meet Neil Worthington, who lets out this cottage to hundreds of Nora Batty fans. I've come to the Wrinkled Stocking Cafe. You can guess who that's named after. And actually, I'm terribly sorry, I didn't ask your name.
Susan Gardner.
Do you and your husband run them?
We do, yeah. We own the tea room.
Yeah. So how do you feel with this news about Kathy?
It's very sad. I mean, she'd already been written out of filming this year, so she obviously wasn't very well. But no, it's very sad and should be sadly missed.
Is she the sort of icon of the series, really? I mean, I guess for people who aren't fans and don't follow it, hers is the name. Her and Compo.
Yeah. No. Everybody, everyone. If ever they think of a battle axe, they come up with Nora Batty, whether they watch the programme or not, don't they?
We all know one.
Absolutely. Yes.
I've just come three doors up from the Wrinkled Stocking along the road, and I'm with it's Neil Worthington. Yes, Neil Worthington, who... he's not exactly the Nora Batty of today, but he owns Nora's cottage. And you, Neil, you were just telling me how that came about, because actually we're sitting in an extremely smart boardroom of what looks to me like a design
agency.
Yes,
yeah,
good.
So we're a design and advertising agency based next door to Nora Batty's. But I bought the cottage about 4 years ago, initially to expand the design business as we grew the business. But due to kind of help from the BBC, we converted it into a self-catering cottage.
Because do they use the interiors at all? They obviously use the exterior, but do they use the interior?
They've used they only use the downstairs kitchen interior for the filming. If you look at this year's Christmas episode, last year's Christmas episode, they did the filming from the kitchen looking outwards. But the living room, the bedrooms, and all the props are based from the series. And the BBC supplied us with quite a few props to kit the cottage out.
Oh, very good. So if you're staying in the cottage, you can use her teapot or her stocking ironer or whatever it might be.
We have a creel with the pinnies over the fireplace. We've got the rag rugs. And again, a lot of the props used in the filming are actually throughout the cottage. I think we've got over 800 photographs as well on the walls, which are going back over the last 25 years, showing all the scenes and cast and crew and so on. So it's a complete, it's a complete Nora Batty experience.
Martin Wainwright in Home Firth. Getting a job is a daunting prospect for anyone leaving college or university, but particularly so for young opera students, because there are only a few opera companies around who might be able to employ them. Bel Canto in the City of London aims to give students the opportunity of performing before an audience while their audience dines. Education Guardian's Donald MacLeod went along to check out the singing and the food.
Are you ready to order yet?
I'd have the salmon for starters.
Yes.
And the beef for a main course.
My name is Michael Davis. I'm a baritone at Bel Canto. Bel Canto is a concept venue. You have a show which every 15 minutes you have an ensemble or an aria from the most famous operas by Mozart, Verdi, Puccini, and you don't have to go to a different place to have your dinner because you're served at your table from the comfort of your chair with both music and food.
The duck au foie gras, please.
It's very much in the tradition of the grand 19th century romantic opera house. We have red wallpaper, lavish red curtains.
The restaurant is set out in a way that it's quite spacious. There's lots of room for the singers to be able to move around. We interact and act with each other a lot. We're able to be quite personal with the guests at the restaurant.
Thank you. Medium over there, sorry.
I'm Carlene Ebbs and I'm a soprano. I've just finished studying at the Guildhall. I spent 2 years doing postgraduate study there, and previous to that I did 5 years of study in New Zealand, which is where I'm from.
How come you're singing in this slightly lavish setting tonight?
I've been singing at the Bel Canto for the last couple of months, and for me, as someone who's trying to find work having finished study, this is a really good way of airing new repertoire and performing for an audience at regular times to be able to practice new repertoire in public and things like that all the time is really good.
So is life tough for an aspiring opera singer?
I think it's very tough, yes. There's lots of competition and you're studying very long hours, trying to perfect the languages that you sing in, but also you have to try and earn a crust too, so to juggle everything, it is very difficult. My name is Tyler Clark, I'm a tenor, and I'm studying at the Royal College of Music on their opera course.
So, singing at Bel Canto, will this help you on your career, do you think?
Yeah, I think it boosts your confidence, it helps you to be very direct in your communication, so I'm sure it benefits us.
It is really tough, especially being a soprano, because there are so many sopranos. So it's incredibly competitive. There are so many people wanting the same opportunities, and there are so few opportunities around at the moment.
Good evening. I am Jean-Paul Morel, one of the owners of Bel Canto in London. We were trying to find an original concept for a venue around opera singers.
And is it proving a success in the 2 months you've been open?
The success is coming slowly. Now we have our team of artists, and we can receive the public.
Now, Bel Canto is situated in the heart of the city of London, which, as we know, has been hit by the credit crunch. Is this a bad time for your new venture?
We are not a bank. We are a venue with music, entertainment, and we try to give better mood to everybody.
The chocolate for dessert.
Chocolate mousse.
Yes, yeah. Please.
So do you do any waiting at tables as well?
Yeah, we do. But, I mean, obviously we're singers before we're waiters and waitresses, so the heavy and the difficult stuff is left to the professionals.
I think the waiting is more of a chance for us to speak to the people that come and introduce what we're singing rather than using us as waiters or waitresses.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
These are student opera singers that you you use here at Bel Canto. I mean, are they good?
They are excellent, because the level of today in the School of London, like a Guildhall School and the Royal Academy of Music, the level is very good, and it's very renowned in Paris.
Are you enjoying the evening?
It's very enjoyable.
What about the quality of the singers?
Well, I think the quality is, we were just talking about how they pack a big punch in a fabulous setting, and also it doesn't feel intrusive at all. You can still enjoy your dining experience as much as sort of listening to the entertainment, so that's great.
Do you hope to be spotted tonight?
Well, that would be amazing, but I don't think any of us really do it for that reason. We do it so that we can continue performing and improve as performers, deal with nerves on a regular basis, things like that, as opposed to coming along to be spotted.
Donald McLeod. Today's edition of Guardian Daily was produced by Phil Maynard and Francesca Panetta. I'm John Dennis. Thanks for listening.